I'm David Karas, and you're listening to Politico, Conversations in Political Economy.
Trying to do a decolonial exhibition in Eastern Europe from a global perspective, which looks at the experiences of the Global South and Eastern Europeans together, is kind of a new thing. So the trans-periphery concept is actually about how to do transnational or transregional history, and how to offer this global perspective by looking at the interconnections and the traces of how these histories are written into each other.
I am talking today with Zoltán Ginelli, a Hungarian critical geographer whose research repositions the semi-peripheral experience of Hungarian modernization in a global context by studying the many points of connections linking ideas, expertise, institutions, and political utopias in Hungary to other peripheries in the post-colonial global south. Zoltán has co-curated a fantastic exhibition in Budapest entitled The Trans-Periphery Movement, where he examines trans-peripheral connections in collaboration with a host of artists and scholars. We talk about Zoltán's own research on postcoloniality, race, and global history from an Eastern European perspective, and the themes through which the exhibition tackles these topics.
My name is Zoltán Ginelli. I'm based in Budapest, Hungary, and I'm a critical geographer. I graduated at ELTE in Budapest. Most of my research deals with global colonial history from the perspective of Eastern Europe, and specifically the relations between Eastern Europe and the global south. Or we might say, how to understand Eastern Europe from the perspective of colonialism. And I'm an independent researcher, so I'm not based at an institution.
Let's now try to explore a little bit your intellectual journey or trajectory. So can you talk a little bit about your background as a scholar? So the people or the institutions, the groups that shaped your understanding, your theoretical framework for dealing with the topics that you just mentioned?
Oh, yes. Well, there were many. I would like to start with my family background because it actually will lead us to, you know, the questions that I'm dealing with. My mother taught psychology at university and my father was in physics. And he's an engineer mind who did research in electronics. And he was actually responsible for the first solar energy panel factory in Hungary. But he was also responsible for my curiosity in Eastern European experts working outside of Europe and the West, particularly in the global south, and how these projects not only changed their individual lives, but also influenced their sending countries' development. I was born in 1984. And then we lived for 4 years in Singapore from 1991 to 1995. For us post-socialist Eastern Europeans, right after the system changed, the East was the West. So the anti-Western and illiberal Singapore offered all the Western goods and services we couldn't previously have access to. And after 1989, there was not only a problematic transition to capitalism, return to Europe and the West, but also a brain drain, which was also carried out by East Asian development states such as Singapore. So my father was offered even a Singaporean citizenship, which he refused. And that's how we returned back. So this story of circulation and globalization, of how the internationalization of his career led to developing solar energy panels in Hungary, is something I'm also looking in my research. It's also about the failures of Hungarian trajectories of catching up and development due to competition and structural conditions of global capitalism. And it's also about the internationalization of the careers of Eastern Europeans through the global south. And my background is that I first studied philosophy and history. For example, I was very much interested in how ancient cultures connected globally, connection between Chinese and Roman empires, and also the colonial encounter. So how these differences were played out between these different civilizations and cultures. Now, I graduated in geography and did my PhD studies in geography. And my first intellectual breakthrough was in 2009, when I decided to pursue an academic career. And that was when I read David Norbert Livingstone's article, Race, Space, and Moral Climatology, which is about the hundreds of years of Eurocentric discourse on geographical determinism. So how human and moral development is linked to climate. So this colonial discourse fascinated me and how this is linked to capitalist accumulation, the slave trade, etc. And I saw Hungarian geographers reproducing the same discourse. So how geography was essentially colonial science and how little research has been done about this in Hungary fascinated me the most. And the second turning point was also connected to Livingstone, was looking at the geographies of scientific knowledge. At our university, we had no Western literature available in the 2000s in geography. I read everything in Western literature in human geography online, and I wanted to develop this literature in education in Hungary. Now, later on, I realized that this is a form of self-colonization, and I turned to understanding how and why Hungarian geography makes a difference and is not simply a case of some, you know, Western theory or concept. So my PhD project, I'm writing a book about the global history of the quantitative revolution, so how Cold War geography evolved, has also turned into a colonial history, how these various colonial contexts come together from, for example, Nazi Germany's Eastern Europe to the global south of USA to Western Africa or India, for example. How these are interconnected in the global circulation of knowledge. And the third was another breakthrough, which was a community-based kind of breakthrough, our joint work with the public sociology working group HESET. HESET means situation or position in English. It's an intellectual group which tries to deal with how Eastern European history and Hungarian history can be understood from the perspective of world systems analysis and the specific semi-peripheral position in the, would say, modern capitalist world economy, how Hungary integrated in the long durée into this global capitalism. And there are two things connected to this. One was, it was actually also a trajectory to build an alternative academic framework against the very hierarchical and provincial formal institutional system. Think about universities or the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. So how to build a horizontal, democratic, relatively autonomous group and network of people, and also extend it to Eastern Europe. And how to influence anti-systemic leftist critique in Hungary and work together with policymakers and build cooperative solidarity economies. I'm not part of this group anymore because of my own work commitments, but I think we realized that the group members were economically very dependent on the formal institutions, the universities and the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, or went to work or study at CEU, or lived on extreme precarity. So you cannot do such grand project like this without serious attempts to build joint material interests. So that was one thing, but I'm also connected to various other institutions like the Karl Polanyi Research Center for Global Social Studies, which is a research institution based at Corvinus University. And the second thing, this connects to the intellectual trajectory, is it how to use, you know, world systems analysis and how Eastern Europe and Hungary integrated into the capitalist world system. What has been de-emphasized from this, in this anti-systemic critique, is the relations between the semi-peripheries and the peripheries. So very often this leftist critique of global capitalism is focused on the West. So the critique of global capitalism is actually the critique of the hegemonic West. And that is a problem because to achieve, you know, revolutionary change, you have to look at the horizontal or sometimes also hierarchical relations between the semi-peripheries and the peripheries. And this is something that I could look into when I was working with Professor James Mark from the University of Exeter. We're still working together, but there were two particular projects which I was working on as an assistant researcher. One was the Socialism Goes Global, which was particularly interested in the relations between the so-called second and third worlds. The other one was 1989 after 1989, which focused on the global history of 1989, the system change in Eastern Europe. Right now, we are writing a book for Cambridge University Press on the history of Hungarian coloniality in the 20th century. And it is a problem that in Hungarian academia, I feel rather isolated, which is largely due to not getting a stable position. But I also think that in developing our international academic networks, which I continue mostly with historians, but also I follow very interdisciplinary paths, so I don't like to be locked into blocks. I work with students, teachers, artists, activists and policymakers. Ironically, few geographers are in this particular field, which is global history and the colonial history of Eastern Europe, which is a problem. But I also think, turning back to my point of what we need to do, I think is develop relations not only with Western institutions, because that's the common habit of Eastern Europeans. We try to get stable jobs through the West and make careers through the West. I think there is a great need to develop relations within the region and also with non-Western people and institutions. Why not develop academic connections with India or with Ghana or with Nigeria or with Latin American country? This trajectory is constantly turned down, even by Eastern Europeans themselves, due to the Eurocentrism and Westcentrism of the field.
You hinted at this, but can you flesh out a little bit whether there is an explicit or implicit political dimension to your work and your reflection as a scholar?
I consider myself as an anti-systemic leftist scholar. So my work is also connected to understanding the socialist era from a global perspective and the ways that we were actually integrated globally. And we had a role in influencing the ideas of socialism. I try to be progressive in what I do in battling racism and opening up these national histories, canonite histories, from the perspective of global history, and build these connections between semi-peripheries and peripheries, as I mentioned. But I like to collaborate with people who might consider themselves conservative or as part of various other political fractions. I see the problem that many leftists build their own intellectual bubbles and don't really communicate with other people. And the second thing I find very problematic is that many leftists are actually very Eurocentric. Their critique is very much locked in looking to the West and not elsewhere.
You already referred to the fact that collectively with other scholars at Hazet Mühe, the Public Sociology Working Group, you have been influenced by the rediscovery of world system analysis for understanding the positionality of Central Europe and Hungary. But what is the specificity of your understanding or your approach to world system analysis relative to maybe other framings?
So my work is a combination of world systems analysis and post-colonial or decolonial thought with a geographer's perspective and toolkit. Now, this makes a difference. And most of world systems analysis would start from macro data, which has some positivist and analytic leanings. It's also based historically on systems theory, which is good because it is holistic. It says that all things are interrelated globally. So development happens at the expense of others. So this is an important thing to think about when we're dealing with center-periphery relations. However, a lot of world systems analysis classics, even Wallace Stern himself, is Eurocentric. Most of these people are, these classics are neo-Weberian Marxists. So they write a lot about the role of city-states, Westphalianism, the genealogy of the nation-state, and the development of capitalism is something that is specific to Europe and the West. And this is a problem. So my main influence was André Gunder Frank and not Robert Brenner or Paul Sweezy, who are very Euro-Marxist. Even if you read the Dependentistas, much of their work were filtered through North American science, right? So some other authors like geographers like James Morris Blount was very instrumental and helpful for me on delivering this critique of Eurocentrism and understand world system analysis from the perspective of Eastern Europe, which is considered as a semi-periphery in global capitalism, from the perspective of colonialism and race. So the combination of world system analysis and post-colonial studies and decolonialism was very fruitful for me for understanding how these relations between the semi-periphery and the periphery evolved. And also these dimensions of race, how to understand whiteness in world systemic terms, how to understand whiteness in Eastern Europe. It cannot simply be a case study of white superiority or whiteness as it was conceived in post-colonial studies or critical race theory in the West, and also by scholars from the Global South who very often take us as white and hegemonic, although we are actually not part of this kind of Western trajectory of colonialism, which came up with the idea of race in the first place. So there's this lost in the middle, in betweenness position of Eastern Europe, which I try to understand. And I think the trajectory that we started with Hayzet originally, as I said, really focused on the West. There were a few questions which try to understand the critique of post-colonial studies, which is very West-centric, from the perspective of Eastern Europe. So this is something that led me to another project, which is called Decolonizing Eastern Europe. And I'm the founder of this group on Facebook, and we also have a Twitter account. And I use this to gather the, you know, magnificent and fascinating work of other scholars in the past 10 years who have been trying to understand this kind of global colonial history of Eastern Europe.
So you mentioned the ways in which we realize that the conceptual apparatus of many of the people engaged in either, you know, Marxist or global approaches such as world system analysis were tainted by the Eurocentric experience and Eurocentric concepts. But once we understand this, how can we apply this sensitivity to the racialized and colonial aspects of our interpretation of global history for uncovering new understandings of how the global system of capital accumulation, but also knowledge production, is structured?
Yes. So all this, what I've said, is also about the conflict between world systems analysis and post-colonial studies. In my work as a global historian, I combine the two, and you can easily understand, as I said, whiteness, so this kind of racial position, which I would call peripheral whiteness or a frustrated whiteness of Eastern Europeans, of being in between, being not quite white, trying to catch up to the West, but also, you know, demonstrating and performing their whiteness against the global South or the colonial world. But also, you know, having a history of having been colonized by various imperial powers. And I think my work focuses on this idea that although it is common to say that we never had colonies, and therefore we have, you know, no responsibility and no guilt for colonialism, and there is no colonial history of Eastern Europe. Why should there be? All my case studies and my research tries to refute this argument and show that, you know, colonialism was a transnational project. I look at this particular semi-peripheral integration of Hungarians into global colonialism. One example is I look at the relations between Hungary and Ghana after Ghana became independent in 1957. And you have the Krumah regime, which tried to lever dependency against the West. There was a huge debt and financial dependency. They got lots of loans to build the Akosombo Dam and resettlement projects due to the Volta Lake, which was an artificial lake because of this hydroelectric dam, and also the many industrial projects industrializing Ghana. And to lever this dependency, they built connections with Eastern European states. And the Hungarian case is very interesting because for Hungarians, this Ghana relation offered for the Kádár regime after 1956, the opportunity to open up globally and from international isolation, because you had the Hungarian question there in the United Nations due to the 1956 revolution. This offered not only a diplomatic opportunity, but also an economic opportunity to open up to the wider markets, export markets in Africa. And it also offered the opportunity to export knowledge and export planning knowledge. And Hungarians were very adept to work on how to build a centralized planning economy and how to industrialize an agricultural economy. And this is something that the Ghanaians wanted. So my case study looks at the example of József Bognár, who was a forgotten but very important development economist in Hungary, and how Krumah asked him in 1961 to develop the first seven-year plan in Ghana. And there were also other works commissioned by Ghanaians. One example is of János Fekete, who's well known as a banker later on, who tried to trick the West with concealing our debt when we had to take up loans from the IMF. Already in this era, János Fekete was working as a secret advisor for Ghana to help Ghana come out of this kind of debt-ridden economy. And the József Bognár's trajectory led to the development of the Center for Afro-Asian Research in 1963, which drew together various intellectuals who then greatly influenced the Hungarian reformist movement of the new economic mechanism, which kicked off in 1968.
Right. So can you talk a little bit more about this? Because this is really a fascinating story of the connections of Hungarian experts and other post-colonial countries. What is exactly the type of expertise that was shared here? And how was it implemented? And what were really the consequences on the ground in the implementation of these projects?
Right. So Ghana became a big promise of developing Africa. It was considered by many planners as a sort of laboratory of development where different concepts could converge and you can find out the best combination to develop an African country. So the Hungarians in Ghana were involved in combining this knowledge with an international board of experts. So you could see on this board, which Bognár put together in Ghana to discuss this first 7-year plan, you could see people like Western development economists like Michael Kádor, who was Hungarian-born, but you could also see Samir Amin, who was then from Mali. And what was fascinating for me to see is that Bognár developed a very mathematical approach and a systemic approach to develop the national economy. He offered an agricultural development plan, which was based on his background of being connected to the peasant movement in Hungary and the folk riders.
Let's pause here for a second. Zoltán is fleshing out that these Hungarian planners and economists advising Ghana in the 1960s were in fact largely influenced by their own personal experience growing up in an impoverished and agricultural Hungary in the interwar period. In post-colonial sub-Saharan Africa, they saw a reflection of their own youth. The Hungarian folk writers who influenced these experts had been a group of artists and intellectuals who championed agrarian reform and redistributive social policies in the 1930s. Among them, some linked this cause to a nationalist agrarian utopia, while others later embraced fascist or even state socialist modernization projects.
This is one thing. And the second thing is that it was very Western knowledge recalibrated as a state-centralized way of developing the whole plan. And this is something that he could only do in Ghana. And later on, he could go to other places like Burma in Asia and in Africa to advise those regimes and economies. So this actually opened up Hungary to the wider post-colonial world and the market of development advocacy. Bognár himself was very keen on coming up with an export-oriented growth model, which was based on these experiences and also by the prospects of exporting Hungarian goods into these new markets in Western Africa and South Asia. So this kind of export-driven growth model, which required specialization in industries, greatly influenced the whole trajectory of the new economic mechanism and also later on the regional development planning in Hungary of where to locate what factories and what type of industry should be developed, which was, for example, electronics and the textile industry.
It's really fascinating because what you're describing here is not just purely the replication or the application of policies or experiments or institution building that were perceived to be successful in Hungary to other countries, but it's also basically testing out ideas and policies in these countries for trying to reapply them in the Hungarian context. I would still like to hear you talk a little bit about what was the place of race in these relations.
Okay, before I do that, I just want to point out to this kind of wider process of what happens is that the expertise that was developed in the interwar period gets reused and reapplied in the context of decolonization, particularly Afro-Asian decolonization after the Second World War. So there are various expertise, for example, hydro engineering or development economics, which Hungarians get a very solid and strong global position due to the process of decolonization and these new alliances. Turning to race, in this Cold War context, what happens is that the ideology of socialist internationalism results in alliances with these post-colonial countries, which are based on racial solidarity and anti-colonialism against the West. Now, this is a very strongly state-supported trajectory based on the structural conditions, the need and the pressures to internationalize and globalize their economies. So the ideas promoted through and in this kind of socialist internationalism is really linked to the particular political economic trajectories of these countries, in which they received relatively high autonomy from the Soviet Union, which is largely overlooked. So there were various models competing even with each other and trying to demonstrate that this whiteness of theirs, this Eastern European whiteness, is actually a more solidary whiteness. And after crumbling of Western Empire, they can demonstrate that they are actually the good whites. They are actually the whites who could have become better imperialists because they are more solidary. And one particular connection that they tried to develop is that demonstrating that they also have been colonies and they were also colonized. And the immediate experience is the Second World War. Think of the Holocaust and, you know, Nazi imperialism. But also this leads to the silencing of Soviet imperialism. So in my research, what I also try to do is not just focus on the history of state socialism from a global perspective, but to look at the other side, which was the anti-communist refugees. And these were largely also connected to the peasant movement and to the folk writers. And many of these people are socialists. Some are very conservative. Some are even might be called fascists. But I focus on these folk writers who try to develop, because of their refugee status, they flee to the USA in most cases or in Germany. They develop this discourse of Soviet colonialism. And they develop this discourse on the same basis and in the same ways as their socialist counterparts. Staying in the East, they build on this Eastern European history of colonialism, right, to demonstrate that actually we've always been, you know, colonized. And now the Soviet Union is colonizing Eastern Europe. So it tried to build alliances with the Afro-Asian countries. And I focus on the former Prime Minister Ferenc Nagy, who was expelled in 1947 by Rákosi and the communists. And I have a case study of looking at how Ferenc Nagy influenced the first Afro-Asian conference in Bandung in 1955, which is a totally forgotten history. So the history of Bandung is kind of developed, and you have lots of books on Bandung. Nowhere can you see the role of Hungarians in influencing Bandung. And the ways Nagy tried to do this is he was supported by the CIA through the Free Asia Foundation, which was largely run by the Rockefellers, and which focused on expansion of U.S. interests in East Asia, right? So that was a focus. And they funded his South Asian trips. So he went through South Asia, through the Philippines, through Indochina, and to India and Pakistan. And he met with most leaders and diplomats. One particular connection is Kotelawala in Ceylon. And he was the one, Kotelawala in Bandung, who in his speech put forth the argument that condemning of colonialism, we also have to include Soviet colonialism and Eastern Europe. So this was one particular trajectory. And there was this, what I call the clash of colonialisms, when these two fractions, the communists staying in Eastern Europe, in the Eastern Bloc, and the anti-communist refugees race in the post-colonial world to develop their own ideas of anti-colonialism. The refugees supporting the West and, you know, attacking the Soviet Union, and the communists attacking the West and supporting the Soviet Union. And both of these Eastern Europeans use the same historical experiences of Eastern Europe to put forth this argument that we always were a colonial space. We have this colonial history, and that's why we need to build these solidarity networks.
And what happens after the end of the Cold War? So what happens to these established contacts between Hungarians and other Afro-Asian post-colonial countries? And what happens also to not just the policies themselves or their projects, but also to the memory of these points of connections once state socialism collapses?
Yes, what's fascinating is that all of these histories are at least partially forgotten. Already by the 1980s, because of pressures of global indebtedness and, you know, the rise of neoliberalism, and then you have this financialization drive, which ends up totally shattering all these developed solidarity networks between the semi-periphery and the global periphery. So all these previous connections are shattered because all these countries become indebted, and they start to pay back the West and not each other. So the system change in 1989 is largely propelled because of indebtedness. And this indebtedness is not only towards the West, but also to the Middle East, Middle Eastern countries. For example, we gave huge loans to Iraq and African countries, and they couldn't pay us back. So the solidarity network shattered. And there was also what I would call the white revolution of the 1980s. So to understand 1989 from the perspective of race would entail thinking about how this region was re-whitened and how socialist internationalism was taken as something that is black, that is colored because of this, you know, racial solidarity and anti-colonialism linked to the socialist internationalism idea. And this turn to capitalism, this return to Europe and transitology also meant turning back to whiteness and demonstrating our whiteness and our Europeanness. And this also led to shattering and forgetting these relations. But also from the perspective of Global South, 1989 meant the resurrection of white empire. So the expansion of NATO and the expansion of the European Union also meant that these former links, which were used to lever dependency against the West and to construct different and alternative global economic systems and political utopias, think about non-alignment movement, which was not only connected to Yugoslavia, Tito, and the Afro-Asian countries, but also to some other Eastern European countries who tried to connect to this non-alignment. One particular historical moment is in 1956, when some intellectuals like István Bibó, who was a politician, or Árpád Göncz, who later became the president of the Republic of Hungary, tried to use this moment of revolution to develop alliances with India and with Nehru. And they were partially successful, but then the Soviet Union stepped in. So this was a moment when Hungary could have, you know, stepped on the Yugoslavian path and joined in alliance with these Asian non-aligned post-colonial countries, but it failed. I just try to raise this historical moment because in our canonized national histories, you think about 1956, you think about 1989, or maybe the independence wars of 1848. All these moments in history are used by government and even now the Orban regime politically and put into narratives which are not only nationalist in the terms of keeping out all this interconnectedness with these countries, but also that they have been whitened after 1989 due to this anti-communist revanchism, which led to forgetting our relations with the third world.
Can you expand a little bit on this, especially in the current context, where on the one hand, we have a rewhitening of Hungarians' self-understanding after 1989 and their collective sense of identity as a basis for understanding their place in the world. But then we have this big crisis between 2006, 2010, the collapse of the legitimacy of the type of neoliberal embeddedness in global markets and the current nationalist conservative regime, which attempts, harking back to this heritage of socialist linkages to countries such as China, such as India, such as Central Asia. There is a revalorization of the ethnic identity or origins of Hungarians as not being purely Europeans. So it's a very complex situation because on the one hand, this is an extremely xenophobic regime that builds a lot of its discourse around racism, explicit and implicit forms of racism. But on the other hand, it tries to leverage also these interconnections to non-Western parts of the world.
Yes, it's very complex. I think the main failures of a leftist anti-systemic critique against the Orban regime is that they fail to understand this kind of semi-peripheral racial position. This opening to the East trajectory, which is locked into the, you know, wider expansion of China and this macro project of the New Silk Road, etc. And the government has been turning towards ideologies such as Turanism, which were developed from the 19th century, late 19th century on, but they gained prominence in the interwar era and they were strongly connected to very racist ideas of Hungarian whiteness as combined with a sort of Asianness, as Hungarians have roots in Asia. So these ideologies and the ideas of geopolitics have been redeveloped and resurrected. Now, this is not just a turn back to some kind of imperialist and racist thinking as it was in the interwar period. It's a much more complex issue, which shows that Hungarians never considered themselves as totally white because we have this wider histories of being on the borderlands of Europe and being partly Asian and partly white, being partly Western and partly Eastern. And what the Orban regime does is simply just exploiting this wider historical discourse. So they're just exploiting these ideologies, but they're also exploiting the remnants of the socialist world system. So these connections with what we have today, with even Western Africa, but with development projects, investments in Mongolia or in Central Asia and towards China, are built on these former experiences and connections that we developed during the socialist era. The ideology is different. So what happened after 1989 is that the socialist internationalism as an ideology broke down. So Hungary had to come up with a different global ideology to which can position itself globally. And I think that the Orban regime was successful in trying to produce various global ideologies. But one is Christianity. And they often think of Christian democracy as conceived by Orban as a very nationalist thing, and they consider it from the perspective of Hungary and Europe. And we often conceive it as something that's very racist because it connects to racist and Eurocentric, because it connects to whiteness and our global privilege as a European civilization against the East and the South. But what the Orban regime does, and you have to understand that most of the Christian population is non-European in the world. In fact, in Africa, there are more Christians than in Europe right now. So what the Orban regime does is they try to build alternative diplomatic networks through Christian institutions, churches. You saw this 1 million euro donation to a Nigerian church last year. And what you see from the left and the political opposition is just this very Eurocentric and equally racist criticism of why are we giving, you know, money to the black Africans? They should develop themselves. They fail to understand this kind of new global ideology that they use not only inside Europe and inside their countries to develop their own, you know, national bourgeoisie and their own populist politics and propagandas and agendas, but also to maneuver globally. This is something that I think is a problem. You can see that these global ideologies are in Hungary and in Eastern Europe, have a much wider history. If you want to understand how the Orban regime tries to maneuver globally, you have to consider this more than 200 years of being in a semi-peripheral position in the global capitalism, because then you can see that what the Orban regime does is actually opening up to our existing and almost natural export markets in the Middle East or in Central Asia or in North Africa, for example, Egypt.
Now let's turn to the exhibition that you have curated. I would just like to first clarify what the exhibition physically looks like. What does it present? What are the materials on which it builds?
Yes, thank you. This is an art and documentary exhibition. So we're working together with artists and we're working together with researchers. We have lots of archival and documentary materials, but we also have commissioned art projects. I'm working together with an art historian and creator, Esther Sokac, who worked at Transit Hungary and now is doing a PhD in Amsterdam. Physically, the exhibition will feature a lot of photographic materials. Most of these photographic materials are archival, so they are from private collections or institutional collections. This whole exhibition project and the materials reflect this kind of wider global history, which we try to tell. What we try to do, and this is, I call, strategic nationalism, is since that the exhibition will be in Budapest, we try to focus on Hungarian figures and people and stories and narratives which were canonized by Hungarian history. Think of Miklós Radnóti, the poet, or Dezső Kosztolányi, the writer-poet, were well known, but their connections with Africa are less known, or their connections and ideas about race are less known. And we also focus on things like Trianon or 1956 and try to offer a different narrative which globalizes these historical moments and puts them not only in a global, wider global relations, but also how these may be understood from the global south and how these are connected to the global south. Physically, the exhibition will feature a lot of films too. So some are archival films and some are artwork. The exhibition will be in a physical space in Fészek Művész Klub in Budapest, but also running on our own website called transperiphery.com. And we had to put a lot of materials online due to the pandemic. We put our materials into so-called episodes, which can be understood in themselves, but also they are related to each other in various ways. And these interrelations are what we will call transperiphery. So the transperiphery concept is actually about how to do transnational, transregional history and how to offer this global perspective by looking at the interconnections and the traces of how these histories are written into each other. And these histories are largely those which, although we have always seen, for example, we saw 1956 revolution, we saw Trianon, and we saw all these things in Hungary, but we never saw these as interlinked in this wider or transperipherial history of how this links to, for example, Hungarian colonists in Latin America or the understanding of negritude and Africanism in Hungary, how these travelers from Eastern Europe interacted with people and context in the global south. So we have seven of these episodes. One episode is about travelers. Mainly we have Hungarian travelers, but we also have, for example, Du Bois's trip in Eastern Europe during the early 1960s, and how his ideas are contested, but also connected to ideas of race and how he experiences race in Eastern Europe. But also the reception of negritude and the Pan-Africanist movement in Hungary, which is related to Du Bois' trip. But we look at how Du Bois' deep south in the US connects to West Africa, but also connects to Paris in this triangle. You see the evolution of negritude, but we look at this triangle from the Eastern European perspective of how writers and poets in Eastern Europe engage with this literature and engage with this movement in the interwar period, and what this way of thinking and this legacy would mean in the socialist period and could mean to us now. So, for example, we look at how Miklós Radnóti, when he went to Paris in 1931, frequently visited the colonial exhibition in Paris. And it had a big impact on his thinking as a Jew, as a minority, in a very anti-Semitic Hungarian context. What he then does, he translates a lot of African works, sometimes just stories or poems. And this leads to his edited book, Karunga, in 1944, in which you can see that the main figure is the Black African. And these works have been then reused to demonstrate our solidary anti-racial position in the socialist era. So Radnóti has been reinvented in the socialist era as a leftist, probably communist, Jewish anti-fascist figure who, because of these connections, demonstrate our solidary whiteness, which I just explained. But we also look at forgotten writers like Illés Kacér, who is Hungarian, but lives in various places in the Hungarian kingdom. And so after Trianon in 1920, when two-thirds of the country is taken away by this peace treaty, Illés Kacér is in a complex minority position because not only is he a Jew, but he later ends up in Czechoslovakia, where as a Hungarian and as a Jew, he is abused in various ways. And he is the one who writes the first so-called Negro novel in Hungarian in 1936, which is called Ikongo Will Not Die, Ikongo Nem Hal Meg. And this is translated into 14 languages, and he actually gains international fame through this novel. So we're dealing with the reception of this novel, but we also deal with the first Hungarian translation of René Marán's Batuala in 1922. It's translated into Hungarian by Dezső Kosztolányi, who is a very West-centric author. He is an author of the journal Nyugat, which is in Hungarian means West. And this Africanism and negritude is taken into Hungary as a Western culture of racial fascination. René Maran is very instrumental in putting together negritude as an intellectual movement. And in Hungary, you can see receptions right after Trianon. So we're in 1922, 2 years after the Trianon Treaty. A lot of reviews, one particular by Oscar Domu, which writes this critique that is really connected to what's happening right now in Hungary with the reception of Black Lives Matter. He writes that, okay, there's this Western fascination with race and the Negro, the Black people, but why do we need these Hungarians where we've also been colonized and there's Trianon, we live in this peripheral space, and why doesn't the West deal with our peripheral status? Why doesn't the West deal with the rural poverty, massive poverty in the Hungarian lands, in the countryside? So you can see how this kind of anti-racism comes into Hungary as a Western canon, as a form of Western culture, as Black Lives Matter is often positioned by critics as something that's coming from the West. It's an alien ideology, and our history is not about this. And they try to come up with other, you know, counter proposals of a counter colonial histories, right? And the colonial histories of Hungary, which should be respected. So you have this race for recognition, which also happens today. Now, just running through our other episodes, we also deal with the perspective and experience of people from the global South who come to Eastern Europe. So we focus on Afro-Asian students who came to Eastern Europe. We have a lot of people involved. For example, Teresa Stejskalova's work looks at South Asian students who studied film directing in Prague. And we present two of these films. And one of these films deal about the issues of race in Prague at that time in the 1960s. But we also have Bartosz Nowicki, who deals with the same issues of race in the case of Poland. Our other episode deals with Hungarian colonists in Latin America. This shows very well how Eastern Europeans and Hungary was actually involved in colonialism. And this narrative of we never had colonies is false because it's a territorial argument. It doesn't matter who had or who controlled the colonies because the colonies were filled up with so-called white populations. A great number of these colonists were from Eastern Europe. From the mid-19th century, especially in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, millions of Eastern Europeans flocked not only to the USA, but with the restriction of immigration due to racial quotas, which strongly affect Eastern Europeans who are racialized by the Americans, North Americans. Many of these people go, like tens of thousands, to South America. And there are agents going from Brazil or Argentina, immigration agents, who are going down to these deep into these small villages in the Hungarian kingdom, looking for and, you know, trying to convince people to go. So this wider history of emigration, which is a structural condition of the semi-periphery, millions of people leave to the West, but they also leave to the global South, to these former European colonies who later become independent. And this is the way that Hungarians become colonists, sometimes killing Indians, sometimes developing friendship with indigenous people, and clearing the forests in South America. So they live on the colonial frontiers. And this is also something which we try to demonstrate by the concept of transperiphery, that not only are these peripheral stories in ways that they have been marginalized and forgotten, but also that we have to look into the global history of colonialism from the perspective of these people. These people who were moved and abused by the state, by capitalist elites, to drive them into the colonies to work as cheap labor. So how Eastern Europeans were involved is an important case study in this respect. There's also another episode called Networking the Peripheries, which deals with the Ghana story, which I mentioned, and also with the Ferenc Nagy story of constructing the discourse of Soviet colonialism, and how this history reaches back to the interwar era folk writers, and the folk writers joined a global colonial history of how this kind of dependency that the Hungarian economy has against the West, and how these social structures which generate poverty in the countryside, and the position they deal a lot with agrarian reform and the position of peasants, is very similar to what you have in the colonies. And you have this dual system, which Ferenc Erdély writes about, of society, of a comprador bourgeoisie and an impoverished large proletarian or agrarian class, which is similar to what you have in Latin America. So they also write from this perspective of a global humanism, of trying to contest these dependencies by epistemologically and through their writings and through their narratives allying with the colonial world. And the sixth topic we have is Cubans in Hungary, which focuses on the 1980s. In the early 1980s, many Cuban workers came to work in Hungary. And the context of this is global indebtedness, which I've talked about, that Hungary, as many other countries in the Eastern Bloc, struggle with indebtedness and how to pay back loans, and struggle to develop their export economies, to get foreign currency in order to pay back all these loans. And to do this, they developed certain industries, for example, textile industry, as I mentioned. So these Cuban workers work in textile mills. And the second thing, they try to import cheap labor. And these Cuban workers are exploited both by the Cuban state and by the Hungarian state, because most of their pay is transferred back as remittances to Cuba and is taken over by the state. And in Hungary, because they have, you know, little money, not only that they work very cheaply, but they are also locked in this space of the working space. And the second thing is that they are offered other types of work in a semi-capitalistic way of giving extra work for money apart from their factory jobs, which is a way that they can generate income, which they used to, for example, buy goods which they couldn't buy in Cuba. And they send back these goods to Cuba to their relatives. So this is how the semi-periphery and periphery relates to each other. And we did video interviews with those Cubans who still live in Hungary. Most of these people were women. So they were exoticized, they were sexualized by Hungarians, they were racialized. And in fact, the tension was raised to this problem of racism in Hungary because of these beating ups of the skinheads who beat up the Cubans in the late 1980s. And when we did this video interview, what came out of this is that how they explain their experiences now after the 2015 so-called migration crisis, where they too have been racialized in Hungarian society. So now they're living the same experiences as they did in the 1980s sometimes. After a period of, you know, silence, they again are harassed in many ways publicly. So we deal with how this story is embedded in this wider global history of Hungary trying to struggle and maintain its political economic position in global capitalism. And the Cuban workers show how race and indebtedness come together in this semi-peripheral context. And the last topic is called Utopias in Global Socialism, which focuses on the architectural export projects. And this is also about how Hungarian state companies try to produce foreign currency because they were required to by the state. And they were also doing this because it was very profitable. So these export projects were related to North Africa mostly and the Middle East, but sometimes West Africa. So again, you can see this sort of natural export markets emerging through these export projects of North Africa and the Middle East. We have interviews, but we also have lots of plans pouring in from private collections and also from companies like Kösti, and also an industrial planning company, which was huge with more than 1,000 employees called Iparterv. Most of these projects that they did were based in Hungary, but a lot of these export projects in North Africa or the Middle East or maybe West Africa was driven not only the drive for foreign currency, but also to develop other export markets. So these projects were sometimes prestige projects, which were important for local regimes, But in the case of Algeria, which was a prime location for Hungarian architects, work was also housing projects. And even the building of factories, for example, is something that's forgotten in our memory, because although it was essential to build these economies, which had their own prospects of catching up, they needed housing, they needed sanitation, they needed this vast infrastructure, concrete and steel, and they needed hospitals. Hungarians specialized in building hospitals, for example. Apart from these housing projects, we tend to forget these because these are common buildings, right? And these are not, in many cases, these are not grand aesthetic projects. And in this case, our project connects to and builds on the work of Lukas Stanek, whose recent book, Architecture in Global Socialism, deals with the same story. You can also see that from the 1980s on, there evolved not just this kind of modernistic building and the focus on functionality, how to offer cheap and affordable housing, for example, but also an adaptation to local, not only just forms of production, but also technologies and aesthetics. And this you can see in the case of Gulf states, where Hungarian, Polish, and other architects try to adapt to the new requirements of not just providing a functionality, but also an Arabic and Islamic style of the buildings. And then they take these experiences of working on a competitive basis in a global capitalist economy. In these export projects, they take these back to Eastern Europe. And then this is reflected on the built architecture later on after the system change.
Thank you so much for this extremely rich description of the exhibition. In conclusion, I would just like to ask you, what is the follow-up to this very rich project? Is this going to be a basis for further transnational, you know, cooperation with other peoples and institutions for research projects, academic projects, or for further exhibitions? How do you see the afterlife of this exhibition that you have worked so hard to put together?
This exhibition is part of 13 projects of the Obb Biennale Budapest. And the Obb Biennale Budapest is organized every 2 years. It is actually a grassroots artistic movement. So it doesn't have that much resources because it does not get any kind of state funding and does not apply for government funding. We try to put this together largely based on our own resources and our own contacts. So it's actually an experimental project of coming up with artistic projects that are autonomous and that are not linked to certain formal bodies and institutions which would compromise these artistic projects, which we try to evade. We will try to apply for funds to do a book later on and to continue this project in various ways. This exhibition is actually even a smaller format of the vast materials that we have and the connections that we've developed. So we consider this as a pilot project. This is the first time that this concept of trans-periphery movement and this trajectory of trying to do a decolonial exhibition in Eastern Europe from a global perspective, which looks at the experiences of the global South and Eastern Europeans together, is kind of a new thing to do. So it's very experimental. So we're also interested in what will come out of this. And after this pilot project, and also simultaneously, we are trying to build connections not only between artists and researchers, but also between Eastern Europeans and people in the global South, which is very important because often what we have is collaborations with Western people and institutions, or you only have Eastern Europeans. But also we have this project of building the East European Biennial Alliance, which is currently connecting Budapest with Prague, Warsaw, and Kiev in Ukraine. And possibly the exhibition will be featured in Kiev in Ukraine next year. So we'll see what happens.
And what is it that people who are not based in Budapest can access from all this content?
Well, it's kind of hard because currently there's a lockdown. So we can see what we can manage. We'll try to document the whole exhibition the best way that we can. And due to the pandemic, there will be some events that we're doing. One particular event that I like to raise attention to will be a conference that we're doing from the 25th to the 27th of May, which will not be just a common academic conference. It will be open to the public, but we will have discussions between artists and researchers. So we have this dialogue that we often don't have. And most of our materials will be featured in some ways in these discussions during the conference.
If you are interested in Zoltan's research, the transnational networks that he is building, and the Transperiphery Movement exhibition, don't forget to check out the links in the description of this episode. You can also subscribe to Politico via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and a dozen other platforms to follow further conversations in political economy. In the next episode, I will be talking with Jathan Sadowski, a researcher from Monash University, about the nature of digital rentier capitalism. Until then, take care.